This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the wake of the Columbia catastrophe, we knew we wanted to talk with former astronaut Jerry Leninger because he's very articulate and reflective about life in space, the challenges and the risks. In 1997, Leninger left behind his pregnant wife and 14-month-old son to spend 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir. During this joint U.S.-Russian mission, he traveled the equivalent distance of 110 round trips to the moon. The space station was in a state of deterioration, communication with Russian ground control was terrible, and something was always going wrong. Leninger survived a couple of near catastrophes on board, including a fire that raged out of control for 14 minutes. Throughout the mission, he wrote letters to his young son. He recently collected those letters in a book called Letters from Mir. His previous book is the memoir Off the Planet. I recorded this interview with Jerry Leninger yesterday afternoon. Jerry Leninger, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want to start by quoting something that you say in your book, Letters from Mir. You say, launching rockets entails big risks. One cannot argue with that. To most observers, the people inside are brave souls. But when climbing into a rocket, I cannot say that I ever felt particularly courageous or brave. I just did it, primarily because that was what I was prepared to do, and that was what I had been trained to do. Did you ever let your imagination wonder to what it would be like if something went terribly wrong and you did die in space?
I think every astronaut does face up to that fact. I don't know of anyone that dwells on that fact. But yes, we all recognize the risk. Yes, we know, the ultimate sacrifice might be made. But I think we all believe so much in the purpose of what we're doing out there exploring, the honor to represent our countries, to represent our world, that you say the personal sacrifice is worth it. So never anything you had to dwell on, just something that, yes, you knew about and you face it, you deal with it, you try to prepare your family for it. Let your family know that you want to be doing this.
Are astronauts taught to deal with these kinds of thoughts? Are they addressed? Are these like psychological, emotional issues addressed in your training?
I think they are, specifically with a lot of the psychological testing we do. But probably it's the selection process that picks people that have been in tough, difficult situations, have reacted well to those situations. And so it is a very pre-screened group, if you will, based on life experience. Deep-sea divers, parachutists, people have flown off aircraft carriers. We've all dealt with almost suppressing the emotion during the operation, and that's what I talked about at launch, actually. The emotion's there, but during it, you're concentrating on the task. You don't feel particularly brave. You're just doing your job, and your mind doesn't have time to bring the fear up.
Now, what about your family? What about the families of astronauts? They're not doing the task, and their minds are free to wander, and, you know, they love their family very much, and I'm sure are worried about the astronaut that's about to launch off. Are they given any kind of psychological preparation for that? And like, did you talk to your wife a lot about the dangers before you took off for the space station?
I think practically, NASA's done well since Challenger to make sure the family has all the support that they need. They send another astronaut along with the family if the family requests that, or if the family doesn't say they don't want that. It is a big family. You hear it, but believe me, the astronaut corps is a big family. We're together socially. You know each other. You know each other's families. And you actually have a representative that you choose, one of the other astronauts, that should you die, that person is a person that you want to be with your family. And so I think these things are sort of discussed. They're not dwelt upon, and, it's a recognition of it. I just talked to my wife a couple days ago about, did she ever have real fears when I went up? And it was interesting. She said the launch was the thing. And in retrospect, it's probably because of Challenger. Now that we've had this Columbia tragedy, I think people will be on pins on needles on both ends.
Right. Did you say a particularly ceremonial goodbye before taking off in the space shuttle for the space station? Or did you try to keep that kind of emotionally cool so it doesn't get too upsetting?
tough time for me. I can remember it distinctly, rainy day in Houston. You're leaving crew quarters. You're in isolation from then on. And, you know, kissing my wife goodbye and putting my little son in his car seat, car driving away, and John reaching out for Daddy. And, you know, tough moment. So I think, yes, you you know, the raw emotions are there. It took me 5 or 10 minutes to recover and get back in and, you know, join the other astronauts. So we all have those private moments. You try to leave things said and not unsaid before you go on an adventure like that, and a risky adventure.
There are 3 astronauts, 2 Americans and 1 Russian, that are aboard the space station now. And they were supposed to end their tour of duty in March, return to Earth, and come back to Earth on a space shuttle. But now it seems improbable that there will be a space shuttle launched that quickly to take them back to Earth. So my understanding is that they've been told they're gonna have to wait. And I'm wondering, you know, you spent, was it 4 months? You spent five
about
months.
About 4.5, yeah. Close to 5. It's a long time.
Yeah, on the space station, Mir. Yeah. What do you think your reaction would have been? This is just speculation, but, you know, if you had been there more or less ready to come home and hearing about a disaster on
I
a
think
space
I know
shuttle
exactly.
And then waiting, knowing you had to wait more.
It's not even really, it's sort of speculation, but I'll tell you, in my mind, it would have been very, very difficult, and I knew that. On Mir, we had a lot of problems, obviously. We were working day and night trying to keep the space station alive, and I'll tell you, I wanted to get the work done. I did not want to come back, look at principal investigators, scientists from around the world, and tell them I failed, and I did not carry out my mission. So I worked very hard for 4 months, and to be honest, I sort of paced myself, and at night I would have my self-doubts, and I would say, Jerry, you can make it for another month. You can keep this pace up for another 10 days. You can keep going for another 2 minutes. And if the shuttle had not shown up when it did, I know, at least in my case, that I was spent, and it would have been very hard to rise to the occasion and perform in the manner that I wanted to perform. People up there now, Ken Bowersox, I went to the Naval Academy with. I've known him for over 20 years, a quality person. Don Pettit's up there, Nikolai Buderin. You know, again, I think you understand that things can be delayed, and you sort of try to prepare yourself for that. But again, after my 5 months in space, there was no finer day in the world than when that space shuttle was in the rearview mirror coming to pick me up. So it's not easy psychologically to deal with the delay after a long time in space.
What provisions are being made to enable them to stay in space longer than they planned?
Russians have just launched their resupply rocket going up there, and I'm sure they may have modified a few things there, make sure they have all the supplies that they need. My understanding is it's probably till the end of June they're going to be okay. The other thing you have, and it's the same thing we had on the Russian space station Mir, you have a Soyuz capsule parked there at all times for emergency evacuations. And so you still have that means of getting up there via the Russian Soyuz rocket, and you still have a means to return. The Mir, at the time I was on board, they thought if we did abandon it, it was probably unrecoverable. International Space Station probably is recoverable. You can control from the ground, try to keep the systems running. And too early to speculate on that, but these people are not trapped up there by any means.
And I imagine it makes perfect sense to you to wait and do more investigation before launching another shuttle.
Absolutely. And, you know, sort of the good news is that all the data is pointing in sort of one direction, and everything sort of makes sense. Without examining the wreckage yet, and that's a good thing. The sooner you can determine exactly what went wrong, the sooner you can start making corrections. So, you know, the good news is that all indicators are pointing in the same direction, and you can make logical sense of what happened.
During the nearly 5 months you were aboard the space station, you wrote letters to your 14-month-old son. You knew that your son was too young to read them at the time, but I guess you wanted them there as a document of how you were feeling, of what you were experiencing, and as a legacy, if that was necessary as well. You were writing these letters from the isolation of space. Can you describe how the isolation of space compares with, you know, feeling isolated on Earth?
It's exponentially greater. I had been, as I say, a naval officer, middle of the ocean, a lot of ships. I actually did some research of living in isolation in Antarctica. I prepared myself to the best of my ability for that five-month mission. But I'll tell you, the isolation was just profound. You are cut off. In that case, not the nice communication systems that the shuttle or the new space station have, but the Russian space station, poor communications. And it's yourself, in my case, two other Russians. We're only speaking Russian. When we do talk to the Earth every 90 minutes for a garbled 2 or 3 minutes, you're only talking in Russian. And it reminds me of Pascal's Pensées, where he talks about going in a room, closing the door, and are you comfortable with who you are? And you have to face yourself every day, a lot of reflection on what you're made out of. And there is self-doubt. And, you know, pretty confident people. I think I'm a confident person. I think all astronauts are. But I'll tell you, a lot of self-doubt in the evenings when you sit back and say, am I going to perform? I'm out here by myself is what it feels like, and I've got to hold up.
What about your communications with NASA? What kind of communications did you have with them from the space station?
I had essentially zero. It was a Russian space station. We were learning how the Russians operate. It was in the infancy of that cooperative spirit at that time. And so my only only conversations were to the people in Mission Control, Moscow, and again, only in Russian. There was a small contingency, 2 or 3 Americans there that could sometimes listen in. And sometimes I'd have enough communication time to talk in English to them. But it was probably down to once a week and very poor communication. So you are just cut off. And I'll tell you, when I came back, I would just sort of gawk at people and say, wow, look at all these Earthlings, how beautiful they are. Diversity of human beings, what a great gift we have here on the planet. You know, if you sat next to me on an airplane, Terry, I'd be the guy jabbing you in the ribs saying, wake up, you know, talk to me, tell me about Philadelphia, tell me about your show. I wouldn't let you sleep. I would just be overjoyed to be sitting next to another human being.
The astronauts who are still on the space station and are stuck there because we can't launch another shuttle in the near future to bring them down, they're going to be getting more supplies from an unmanned space vehicle. I think it's the Progress. Is that right?
That's correct, a Russian Progress capsule.
And that's the same unmanned vehicle that delivered supplies to you when you were on the space station and also would take your garbage away. You call it the garbage truck in your letters to the sun.
Yeah, it is, because it burns up coming in the atmosphere, and so you just put all the discards in there once you've gotten the good stuff off of it, and then it burns up with all your waste material for one thing and all the excess stuff you have on board.
Now, that isn't a simple procedure either, hooking up with this unmanned vehicle. This vehicle nearly rammed the space station one of the times when you were hooking up, which would have been the end for you and the space station. What's that process like?
I'm not sure if it would have been the end, because actually it did ram the space station about 2 weeks after I left, and my two Russian crewmates were still aboard along with my replacement, Mike Foll, and you remember that drama, rapid decompression, and they, by the skin of their teeth, were able to isolate that module by closing some hatches and keep the space station alive. You know, nothing is trivial in space. Nothing.
What are some of the things you had to get precisely right in order to dock with the Progress?
Everything has to be aligned exactly correctly. And you've got to come in just the right speed. You're too soft, and the two vehicles sort of just repel each other. Without making it too complicated, you're inside the spacecraft trying to fly an incoming spacecraft to dock with the space station. And you do that by looking at a monitor, which reflects a camera inside the Progress. So you're essentially inside the space station trying to fly in a remote-controlled spacecraft. And those views were not so crisp. It gets to the point where you don't even know where that spacecraft is coming in, and you're running from window to window trying to bark out orders and directions to Vasily, who's got the thruster firings in his grip of his hands, which direction to fire thrusters to get this thing to come in, or in our case, to miss us. You know, tough time. Very difficult in space judging distances. And good luck saying, you know, you need to turn right. You know, what does that mean, turn right? If I'm upside down, that might be left.
Right.
I mean, it is very difficult without other objects. You ought to try that one. It's a good mind game. Give yourself no other points of reference, just a spacecraft out there. You know, up, down, left, right, different world. It is a different world. You have to think differently there. And imagine this, you know, both vehicles are going 18,000 miles an hour. You're weighing 100 tons. The space station Mir was weighing 120 tons. You know, my God, how do we do it? That's, I guess, the take home that I have of everything in our space program is, you know, my God, how do we do it? It is incredible what we do. And we build upon our experience in the past. And yes, we build upon, you know, the Apollo 1 fire and the Challenger disaster. And hopefully we build upon what happened with Columbia.
The biggest emergency that you faced, the most life-threatening one, was a fire that broke out on the space station that you had to put out. We talked about this fire during your last visit to Fresh Air, but I just want to talk about it a little bit again. Can you explain, like, how big the fire was and what you needed to do to put it out in space?
Yeah, this fire was in an oxygen-generating system. It was actually the backup system to the failed primary system. Sort of looks like a small garbage can, metallic, filled with a slurry of oxygen-rich chemical, percolates a little oxygen into the air, which, of course, replenishes the oxygen that you need up there as your metabolism burns it down. So we had started one of those devices up. Instead of percolating a little oxygen, the device, which should have absolutely no flame, it's sort of an exothermic reaction to release the oxygen, instead turns into a big fire, and it's a blowtorch. It's a 3 or 4 foot length flame coming out about a foot and a half in diameter, blowtorch-like in intensity, sparks flying off the end of it. Looks like someone lit a box of 100 sparklers, molten metal flying across and literally coating the far bulkhead with pancake-sized splatters. So we've got a red-hot metal-melting fire. Smoke billowing out within 30 seconds, can't see the five fingers in front of your face. Master alarms blaring all over the place. Smoke warning lights, fire warning lights, low voltage lights, everything going wrong very quickly. Nowhere to go, can't call the fire department. Actually, in that case, we didn't have enough capability to get both crews off, so you're sort of faced to three people leave and the other three stay behind. At that time, it was an overlap of the crews, and you couldn't get to the one Soyuz vehicle because the fire was in the way. So, you know, you're committed to it. I guess that's, you know, the same thing with the bravery. Are you brave in that situation? Not especially. You're just trying to survive. You're there. You have limited options. You're committed is what you are. And at that point, I yelled out, we're going to get this fire out. Going to see my family again. We're going to get back to Earth. And, you know, we snapped to, grabbed fire extinguishers, put on respirators, the only thing to keep us alive. Actually, my first respirator failed, and you really need an oxygen, and you're in the middle of the soup of the smoke. Yanked that off, started feeling for the second one, starting to get tunnel vision, feeling like I had swum 50 meters underwater, needing air badly. A lot of thoughts, by the way, went through my head during that minute or so that I'm grasping and feeling my way along the bulkhead, and I can distinctly remember saying goodbye to my wife, saying goodbye to my boy, telling him I loved him.
Was one of the thoughts that was going through your head, I'm sorry I became an astronaut?
No. I always said, I'm sorry I have to leave the world so soon.
But you weren't sorry that you'd become an astronaut?
No regrets. I was doing what I wanted to do.
Have you been thinking about that fire a lot in the last few days since the Columbia disaster?
I guess, you know, I'm really thinking about the families.
Yeah.
You know, I just imagined it. You know, I imagined it. They had it come to fruition and... you know, all I can say is those are some brave people. Feel for the families. You know, it's a great loss to us all.
Have you been in touch with the families at all? Do you know them?
I know them. You know, they weren't the people I trained with from the get-go, but they're people that were there when I was there, and it's a small group of astronauts. So yeah, I know them, worked with them. A lot of small kids. I think there's 13 kids involved, and one slightly older son. You know, big loss, but I think they all know, you know, what their dad, their mom was doing, what it's all about, what personal sacrifice means. And I think they have a lot of pride that their parents were, you know, willing to do that.
I think a lot of Americans until the Columbia had more or less lost track of the space program. Let's talk a little bit about what your mission was. I mean, the space shuttle and the space mission run a lot of experiments. It's not just the adventure of being up there, but there are a lot of tests that the astronauts are helping to conduct. What kind of tests were you running?
You know, it is excitement in a different sense. It's the excitement of science and, you know, trying to push knowledge forward. The big ones were probably the laser beaming at the Earth, dark side of the Earth, just as an example. You don't see the weather. You don't see the cloud cover. And when we try to make weather predictions on the planet, we do it using half the knowledge that's out there. Only the lighted side, the satellite photos, show you the cloud movements. We tried beaming a laser on the dark side and map the clouds on the dark side of the Earth. Scientists get the whole picture, put those data points together, see if they can really understand the Earth as a planet and the whole weather system, for example. More mundane things, you know, I did fire experiments inside a chamber and see how flame propagates, basic properties of fire. For example, it's a sphere in space. It's not flame-shaped because there's no oxygen coming in from the bottom because warm air is not rising. It just uses the oxygen in the boundary layer. Did a lot of medical experiments, a lot of self-examination on myself. And then I did some things that you say, what are your goals up there? One of my goals was to be a world-class geographer. I wanted to know the Earth like no one else ever knew the Earth. And I was doing a lot of experiments, Earth observation to help geologists, for example, looking at fault lines, photographing those, oceanographers looking at plankton blooms. Lots of those sorts of things, and when you're looking out the window, I told myself, I'm going to learn this Earth. And that one has stuck with me. I see a map on the wall, and although I don't have a photographic memory, I do for that. I see a map, and I get a nice, clear flashback to what it looked like from space, and I hope that stays with me the rest of my life. You know, what an incredible planet down below.
And what were your personal observations about the best and the worst effects of weightlessness on the body?
It's incredible. First of all, I got to say the human body is incredible. The adaptability is, you know, boggles the mind. After 1 month, Terry, I'm telling you, I am up there on the ceiling, you know, sucking down some dehydrated borscht, you know, flying around. And I start laughing and say, Jerry, you don't even know you're in space anymore. As comfortable upside down as I am sitting here, as comfortable flying as I am walking. You know, what an organism that can adapt to something like that where everything floats and within a month you're there. It's like you're a spaceman.
And in that sense, you're exposed to a completely different physical sense of reality in space. And I'm wondering, you know, if experiencing such a different geographical reality and physical reality changed your inner self, your inner beliefs, your sense of faith or lack of faith.
I am changed forever. My life's in three phases now, and I think it'll forever be that way. It was 40-some years on the planet, 5 months off the planet, profoundly different world, different perspective of the world, the grand view and that introspection I talked about. And now I'm in a third phase of my life, and I am definitely a different person because of that middle phase.
What about your sense of faith? How that changed, too?
One example, my father's deceased, but I'd be running on the treadmill. My dad told me you could be anything you wanted to be in life. You're in America. You work hard. You study hard. You can be an astronaut someday. I'd be running on the treadmill sometimes, and out of the corner of my eye, I could sense my dad's presence there up in the heavens. He's there with Uncle Bill, and they're laughing and joking like they always did, and he'd say, Jerry, I'm proud of you. Glad you made it.
So this was in the space station you'd have this feeling?
Yeah, running on the treadmill, and again, I sort of have my eyes closed, but I, you know, very strong sense of my dad being there with me.
Mm-hmm.
You look out at the earth, the universe, and, you know, it's just, there is a creator in my mind. So it reaffirmed my faith.
Now, you said, and I've heard other astronauts say, too, that when you look down on Earth from space, and you see this kind of beautiful planet, and you're far from it, that conflicts, wars become even more upsetting and even more unimaginable. Yet at the same time, I think there were plenty of conflicts between the people who were in the space station, and plenty of conflicts between the people in the space station and the people in Russian control. Yes?
Yes. Within the space station, no. I think we were under common danger. It was sort of us against them. And you're right. That's I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, the people in Mission Control Moscow, we started viewing as take them with a grain of salt when they tell us something, because they're not up here. It got to the point where it seemed they wanted us up there at all costs. And we started questioning what they told us and didn't just take order after order after order. The other part of that was they don't realize, or they should have after all their long-duration experience, but didn't seem to realize that you're a human being, you're not a robot, and you cannot tell the person at 9:02 you're going to go to the bathroom, at 9:04 you're going to run this experiment, at 9:06 you're going to do this. So we sort of... and I was probably the leading edge, I'll add, the rebel, if you will, strongly suggested to them that they send us a daily schedule with what needs to be accomplished, and we are professionals, and we will accomplish that. So you're right, there's conflict even, Earth to spacecraft. People ask, what am I doing now and all that, but I'll tell you the one thing I would sure like to figure out is how we can figure out how to resolve some conflicts. And, I'm a naval officer. I understand our need in the military and the great service they do for our country, and I believe in them, believe me. But I think everybody in the military, when you step back and look at it, they say, man, I wish we could figure out a way to solve these things without us having to do our job.
Are these experiences that you're talking about affecting how you see the possibility of war with Iraq?
Probably not. During that time I was up there, it was the Bosnia thing happening, and I'm my grandmother, who's 97 years old, came over on a boat from Slovenia, which is just in that Yugoslavia breakup area there, a small country below Austria. And so I was interested in taking some pictures of my homeland and be able to show my grandma. I got to admit, that was my own personal, a few photos here and there for myself. And it was sad. You go over there, the Adriatic Sea is beautiful, the mountains there, Italy looking like a boot, and you look and you say, what are they fighting over this little speck of land for, and all that pain and all that suffering? My views on Iraq, is probably irrelevant, but I heard a quote that said, war is always terrible, but other things are even more terrible, and there can be things more evil than war, and unfortunately the only way that we've humans have figured out to deal with that is to fight it out and set things right. So it's disturbing to me. I think it's disturbing to every astronaut, but we live in a real world down here, and we ought to spend a lot of brain power, probably the effort that we put into our space station, we ought to spend that brain power and that effort toward figuring out a way to solve these conflicts.
Well, there's several investigations being launched now into the Columbia disaster. There are a lot of criticisms about the level of funding that NASA is getting. Some people are saying, we should limit the amount of funding to the space program. Others are saying the problem is NASA hasn't gotten enough funding, so they're cutting corners, and that's affecting safety. Some people are saying that criticism within NASA is discouraged or even squelched. Where are you weighing in on this? Do you have criticisms of NASA or the funding of NASA?
The latter part I don't agree with, at least when I was at NASA. Again, I think everyone had that common goal of getting out there, exploring space, and doing it safely. So that concern I did not have.
What, that of criticism being squelched?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, people have different perspectives. And I think within NASA, like anywhere, Yeah, you're working on your system. You want that system improved in some way, but someone else is looking at the bigger picture, and there are limitations, and there's budget limitations, and that's always going to be with us in everything we do. And I, you know, to some extent, yes, if you've got a great budget, we can go to Mars. But there is realities, there's constraints, and I don't think NASA was squeezed so hard that they couldn't do things right.
You've been in tight spots yourself in space. Could you speculate at all what it might have been like for the astronauts as they were returning to Earth when the space shuttle came apart?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. The regular reentry at that point, I can remember reentering once, and we yell out tally-ho West Coast, meaning we spotted the West Coast of the United States. And that's right about where the shuttle started having problems. In our case, that was a glorious moment. And so they were probably feeling elated, you know, can't wait to see our families. We see the United States again. We're coming back home. You're going very fast, down to about Mach 18, 18 times the speed of sound. You're now low enough that you're starting to sort of feel the speed. You're down there in the atmosphere, big fireball, turbulence, bouncing around, sounds like a locomotive going to run you down. It's just very, very dynamic phase of flight. You sort of strap back in your seat, you're sitting back, you're concentrating on the task, you're looking at the computer displays, you're looking at making sure everything's looking good. I heard the last call down. It looks like they got a tire pressure warning, and you could hear Rick Husband just being very methodical, calling that warning down to the ground acknowledging that, yes, they are reading the same thing. So they're concentrating on their task. It's right in the middle of a very dynamic phase of flight. The shuttle had just done what's called a roll reversal, so you're sort of pivoting, moving from sort of one wingtip to the other. That had just been completed. That had gone well. Based on everything, the temperature sensor is going up sort of in a gradual way, and then looking like the wires probably burned through and got cut off. I would think things happened very, very quickly after that, and once one bad thing happened, it was probably a cascade at that point. And I doubt there was much time for them to reflect on much of anything. Probably just trying to do their job, just concentrating on the task. And sort of fortunately, it was very fast, very catastrophic. So that's probably what was happening. But I know what was going through my head. My head was, I'm heading home, going to see my family.
You know, from the way you describe reentry, where you're basically in a fireball and you're going 18 times the speed of sound, and it's probably a pretty rocky ride, it feels like a good reentry would feel kind of catastrophic.
Absolutely. It's, you know, there were quite a few rookies on board and people with their second flight. And I can recall, for example, I guess it was my first flight. Dick Richards, the commander, is on his fourth shuttle flight. He turned around midway through reentry with his eyes just big, bugging out, looking at me, and yelled out something I won't repeat, but, you know, holy cow, do you believe this? And then he next snapped back, looked back forward again. And what happens at that phase is you're getting low enough that you're starting to feel the speed. It's sort of like an airplane, you know, climbing out on the wing all of a sudden versus being inside it. Rationally, you know you've got the speed. You had Mach 25, now you're down to Mach 18. But now you're getting low enough that you're starting to see the clouds. You're starting to see objects going by much more quickly down below you. You're inside that dynamic, fluid sort of feeling of the plasma and the fire and the bright orange and the noise and the vibration. And it is, it's sort of thrilling. And you trust your systems, and so you're relaxed. You're not in any way panicking. But I would agree, it's very hard to distinguish what's right and what's wrong in that sort of environment.
I'd like to close by asking you to read a letter that you wrote to your son in February of 1997 when you were aboard the space station Mir. And this letter is reprinted in your collection of letters to your son called Letters from Mir. Before you read this excerpt, tell us what was happening when you wrote this.
At that time, we were about to jump in a Soyuz capsule. That's the unmanned, or I'm sorry, the manned capsule, three-seat capsule, which is the same one, by the way, that should we have to abandon the International Space Station, that crew would be able to return to Earth in. In my case, all we did is move it from one docking node, flew around the space station, and came back to a different docking node. So for us, it was an exciting time. We were able to jump in that spacecraft, take off, and come back home again. And I got to have the great experience of sort of being an old Gemini Apollo astronaut and flying a capsule for the first time.
Can you read that excerpt for us of the letter?
Everything will be fine. But space is the frontier, an unforgiving place, and things could go awry. For example, should we undock successfully and then be unable to redock, the only option would be to head home. There's a limited supply of oxygen and fuel on board a Soyuz capsule, so we could not live in the capsule for long. If we are unable to redock and then are forced to fly home to the planet, after a fiery re-entry, the capsule would come down under parachute and then plop down rather unceremoniously and with a final firm bump in the middle of the desert in Kazakhstan. I would be without my passport. That might be the worst part of it. You know, you can sit here and imagine a lot of less than desirable scenarios. If a thruster, control thruster on our capsule fails to shut off, we get ourselves into an uncontrollable spin. Or if the docking mechanism malfunctions and does not hold us tight enough together to get a good seal, we would be unable to open the doors. Anyone that's tried to fix a leaky faucet knows how difficult it is to get a watertight seal, one that is not too tight and not too loose. Well, airtight is even tougher to achieve. A leak would mean that we would lose all of our breathing air to the vacuum of space should we open the hatch under such conditions. Anyway, everything will be fine. Although we think about those bad possibilities in order to prepare to react appropriately should they occur, the odds are that everything will go smoothly. And it'll be another grand adventure for your daddy, John. I hope that your adventures around the hall, through the kitchen, and into the living room, opening every drawer in sight, unhooking every reachable telephone, and banging every pot and pan, are as enjoyable. Good night, my little adventurer. Give Mommy one of those little kisses of yours for me. Thanks. Love you. I'll be watching over you, Dad.
Jerry Lininger, you made it back to your family. You made it back to your 14-month-old son and your pregnant wife. Did your children have a lot of questions for you when they heard about Columbia and heard about the families whose fathers or mothers didn't make it home?
As I said, Terry, John is in first grade, and we just sort of said that there was an accident and sent him out to make a snow fort. So, you know, they don't need to deal with that. They'll learn about it when they get a little older.
Jerry Lininger, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure as always, Terry. And again, a tribute to all the people. Hearts go out to the families. These are some great people. And I am so proud of the people of the Earth that realize that and are mourning our loss.
Retired astronaut Jerry Lininger. His new book, Letters from Mir, collects the letters he wrote to his son during his 5 months aboard the Russian space station Mir.